The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Romani Arrowsmith from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Rookie Magazine, 17 Magazine, and Glamour Magazine. The theme for today's show is friendship. And this first piece is called Friends Forever from Rookie Magazine. I made my first friend when I was 4 years old. I'd just started attending preschool, and I was shy and timid. I hated approaching people first, which made it a little difficult to make friends. I had a lonely first few weeks there, until I crossed paths with her. It was a long time ago, but even now I remember being drawn to her. She was sunny and blonde, loud and outspoken, and adventurous. Everything I was not. Her name was Julianne. I don't remember precisely how we became friends. It might have had something to do with bonding over favorite crayons during coloring time, and I don't really know why she, popular and gregarious as she was, decided to be friends with a total shrinking violet like me. But regardless of the why or the how, I quickly came to call her my best friend, the person who might as well have been my sister. Our moms became great friends, too, which meant we could spend tons of time together since it was fun for our parents. Eventually, we exchanged the ironclad symbol of forever friendship, glittery matching cord bracelets, and I was over the moon when we began attending the same elementary school a couple of years later. We hung out at recess 3 times a day, skipping rope and playing pretend, and slept over at each other's houses every weekend we could. We leaped off porches into inflatable backyard pools in the summer and traipsed through snowdrifts to gigantic hills for sledding in the winter. We shared closets, messed around with makeup in her full-length mirror, and slid down the banisters at her house when nobody was watching. We were always different, she a daring risk-taker and I a cautious worrywart, but we were steady friends all the way through 4th grade all the same. At 9 years old, we'd been friends for more than half our lives, and I thought we'd stay friends forever. When Julianne's dad got a new job in Nova Scotia, it shook me. Outwardly, I was happy for her. Her family and even Jules herself seemed excited about the move, but internally I was devastated that my oldest friend would be moving literally across the entire country. I tamped those feelings down and told myself that maybe it wouldn't be so bad, maybe we could keep it together with emails. Ridiculously high long-distance phone charges couldn't sever our bond, could they? A sisterhood as deeply rooted as ours couldn't be defeated by distance alone. We'd continue to feel as close, be as involved with each other's lives, and have that same intrinsic understanding of each other as always. I simply couldn't picture life without her. She'd been there from the start. I had school the day Julianne left for her new home. I stood in the middle of the field during recess that day and stared up at the sky as she zoomed 3,000 miles away. I felt heavy, but hopeful. Even as she flew farther and farther from me, I convinced myself that things would stay the same, just with a few additional miles. And for a while, we were together like always. We wrote each other emails via our moms, since neither of us could type, and I got semi-regular updates about her life, her new school, her new neighborhood. I was in the loop the same way I would have been had she been right beside me. Slowly, distance changed the dynamic of our relationship. Time zone differences meant she got ready for bed while I was eating dinner, and gradually, naturally, new friends and new adventures gently started pushing us apart. Every time I received some news about all the cool sights and sounds she was encountering in her new home, I felt a twinge of jealousy quickly followed by guilt. I knew I should be happy that my friend was settling in so quickly and easily, even if I wasn't there to experience it with her. I wanted to feel wholeheartedly elated for her. But I wasn't. Her new life was full of block parties, barbecues, and beaches that made mine seem lackluster. It seemed that while I was pining for my BFF, she was blazing ahead onto new adventures. New places, and the people she met there, began absorbing more of her time, and her emails became shorter and less frequent. After a year or so, I learned more about her life from Facebook updates and conversations between our moms, who maintained their close friendship, than I did from Jules herself. In daily life, she hardly ever crossed my mind, although there were still hints of her. I'd occasionally compare my new buddies with Jules, asking myself what she would do if she were still by my side, or what she would say in conversations I was having, an unintentional response to having spent my formative years in her company. This reflex also nurtured my ongoing relationship with a treasured, idealized version of Jules that existed in my head, while my contact with the real Jules continued to fade. We still wished each other happy birthday, but the super close friendship we'd had, when it seemed like we were always on the same page, as if I could figure out exactly what she was thinking at any given moment, had pretty much dissolved. Occasionally, I would entertain the idea of seeing her again. If we ever reconnected, surely the spark would reignite and we'd be insta besties like we were when we were kids. But I hadn't seen or heard from her directly in so long that I dismissed it as an actual possibility. Then things were scrambled again, just like they'd been in fourth grade, and Julianne's family, who had moved around regularly since leaving for Nova Scotia, was returning to my hometown, and this time it looked like they'd be staying for good. My mom was elated. One of her best friends was returning, but I felt uncertain. For all my fantasies of how happy I'd be to see Jules again, I hadn't actually considered really getting to re-know her. It was bizarre to think that she might be coming back into my life, that she was a real flesh-and-blood person I might be able to interact with. Our separation had turned the reality of her into a hazy memory, the after-image of my nostalgic first best friendship, and I wasn't so sure I really wanted to see her again for fear of shattering that perfect picture. I was a little relieved when my mom mentioned offhandedly that since Julianne was attending University in Ontario, she wouldn't be coming back with her family, and she didn't know if or when she'd be visiting. I could hang on to the dream that we'd click at first sight a little longer. Julianne ended up visiting last Christmas, a few months after her family moved. Our moms were super excited in the days leading up to her arrival. They'd planned a lunch at Cactus Club, saying it would be fun to have all four of us together like old times, and invited one of our mutual preschool friends and her mom along too, in the spirit of the reunion. In the giddy anticipation all around me, I felt guilty that I wasn't exactly feeling the same vibes, but right up until the moment I laid eyes on Jules, I held out hope that our inside jokes, our mutual favorite activities and books and movies, our pseudo-mind-reading abilities, our effortless banter, everything would be the way I remembered it, frozen in a decade-old mental time capsule. I pushed open the glass door of the Cactus Club, and as I walked to the booth where my mom said we'd be sitting, I finally saw Jules, now over 6 feet tall and towering over my 5'3" frame, but just as exuberant, blonde, and blue-eyed as ever. She reached out her arms to hug me, and I obliged awkwardly, partially because of the height difference and because of my general dislike of hugs. I slid into the booth beside her, figuring that it would be easier to speak if I didn't have to stare directly at her the whole time. But despite my cautionary measures, something was off. Our conversation didn't flow. It was stiff and forced, at least on my part. "So what have you been up to?" she smiled, sipping her passion fruit Bellini and tapping away at a text with one manicured thumb.
Well, you know, university's been, busy and stuff.
I scrunched into my hoodie as far as I could, inching my beanie lower down my forehead.
"Cool, yeah, I'm doing a geography major, because, like, why not, right?"
she giggled. She was so glamorous and confident and sure of herself. I wanted nothing more than to run away. I'd never been very good at striking up small talk on the spot, and the added internal pressure to reconnect with my childhood soul sister, heightened by our mother's unstated but rather heavily implied hopes that their daughters would continue to be great friends like they were, wasn't helping at all. I recalled us being so in sync before she moved away. We'd been huge fans of the Powerpuff Girls and always agreed on how to spend time outside school. But now the TV shows we enjoyed, what we liked to do in our free time, our attitudes towards school, were polar opposites. She loved the Vampire Diaries, while I preferred Brooklyn Nine-Nine. She reveled in going out and proposed that we drink vodka and hit up a nightclub while she was in town. I didn't have the heart to tell her that nothing made me more uncomfortable than a crowded dance floor combined with the pressure to get drunk. She was into the fun and parties that school offered, while I felt like a square when I admitted how many hours I spent studying. It seemed like no matter what we talked about, we just weren't clicking the way I'd expected. In fact, the longer we spoke, the more I wanted to squirm away and escape. "This isn't how it's supposed to be," my brain screamed. "This can't be Jules." She resembled my bestie of yore, but everything else about her was entirely unfamiliar. By the end of the lunch, I'd had to face the reality that the stranger sitting across from me definitely wasn't the best friend I'd built up in my mental narrative. We couldn't connect like we used to, and there wasn't much I could do to change that. I couldn't just turn back the clock and transform her into the person I remembered from my past. Our new disconnect wasn't anyone's fault. It was the irreversible effect of time and circumstance. We diverged from one another and formed separate lives, and in our case, the literal and figurative distance that had split us from one another for so long couldn't be overcome by a simple 45-minute reunion. On the drive home from the restaurant, I admitted to my mom that I wasn't feeling the kinship I had hoped for with Jules. I told her I was ashamed that I'd held on to this far-fetched dream, and while it broke my heart a little, that there was a very real chance that the changes that we'd undergone during the time we'd spent apart would prove insurmountable, at least at the moment. It embarrassed me to confess that my rose-colored glasses had made me think that everything might have just stayed the same between us. My mom told me that it was natural to feel the way I did. Even though I hadn't seen Julianne for a long time, she clearly still meant a lot to me, and it was normal to feel sad after letting someone important go. Her advice didn't reverse my feelings, but at least I knew I wasn't being completely irrational, which made coping with the thought of releasing my expectations of Jules so much easier. Jules and I may not be the partners in crime we once were, but I'll always be able to think back to when the stranger across from me at that Cactus Club lunch was my soul sister, my best friend, my whole wide world. She taught me how to speak up when I was a shy preschooler, and how not to let fear stop me from taking on challenges. She dived right into new opportunities, even as a young child, and through her actions encouraged me to do the same, even when I hesitated. Her boldness brought out mine, and I see that now when it comes time for me to give a presentation, read a speech, or raise my hand in a lecture hall of hundreds of students. At that last meeting, she gave me my biggest lesson yet, on cherishing the past while learning to accept the present, without expectations. Okay, that touching story was by Victoria Chu, and this next article is from Glamour.com, and it's by Kayleen Schaefer. It's called, "Female Friendships Are More Crucial Than Ever, So Why Do We Still Love a Catfight?" A couple of years ago, I did something I hadn't done since second grade. I had a birthday party and invited only women. I just moved into the apartment I'd bought on my own, and suddenly it hit me in a way it hadn't when I was busy applying for the mortgage and selecting a stove I would never use, that the space was totally mine. I'd never expected to live alone. I thought my track would be to go from splitting a place with roommates to sharing one with my husband. But now I was in a one-bedroom for which I'd handpicked every single item, down to the white plate that went over the intercom. It was like living in my own fingerprint. This transition felt special. And the more I thought about it, the more I wanted my friends to commemorate it with me. A dozen women came over. I peeked at them in the living room while I was in the kitchen, and they looked so relaxed around my coffee table, talking to one another as easily as if they did this every Wednesday, even the ones who'd never met before. I thought, I love this. These women seemed as at home as I was. Recently, I remembered that night when I read that, while shooting Ocean's 8, Sarah Paulson was asked if she thought there would be actress infighting among her 7 co-stars. "Not in the slightest," Paulson said. "I've never had anything like that happen on set. It's sort of sad, really, that would be the expectation." "I'm pretty confident that Brad and George were never asked if they'd get in a tiff while making Ocean's 11. So why is there still a widespread perception that a bunch of girls can't all get together and be cool? Why doesn't the world see what I saw that night in my apartment?" Catfights, an abridged history. To find answers, I had to look only as far as pop culture. For decades, when TV shows or movies showed more than one woman in a room, we were in for some nasty conflict. In the 50s and 60s, the catfight, say, two women wrestling while wearing lingerie, was a staple of fetish films and low-budget B-movies. The legendary feud between Bette Davis and Joan Crawford made headlines at the same time the male bonding exemplified by the Rat Pack, which included Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., and Dean Martin, was near universally celebrated. Fast forward to today, and the knee-jerk reaction to a group of women remains, if we don't outright hate each other, we're only pretending to get along. It even pops up in our everyday language. The term frenemies, for example, almost exclusively applies to women's friendships. No matter how effusive women are about each other, outsiders, and sometimes the women themselves, often perceive a rivalry. This makes for women who appear to be nice to each other but don't necessarily like each other, an idea that stems from two incompatible things we're taught from childhood. We should be good girls, and if another woman gets something, an award, a promotion, or even a committed relationship, another one of us won't. Women are socialized to believe we can't like and compete with one another at the same time. But thankfully, this is one trope that's starting to end as we see more depictions of female friendships, both fictionalized, think Hilary Duff and Sutton Foster's co-worker friendship dynamic on Younger, and real, like that between tennis champion Serena Williams and Caroline Wozniacki. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. It's hard and lonely at the top, Williams has said. That's why it's so fun to have Caroline. Enter girl squads. Though hashtag squad goals is now a dusty hashtag, it marked a shift in how people view female friendship. Most popular in the back half of 2015, hashtag squad goals and hashtag girl squads applied to many groups, from a bunch of cute puppies to the Teletubbies, but mostly to women who were flashing peace signs on the beach, flanking a bride, or even showing up to support friends enduring genuine hardships like treatment for cancer. Taylor Swift's squad, which included actresses Dakota Johnson and Hailee Steinfeld, and models Gigi Hadid and Karlie Kloss, became legendary. Hadid once explained that their crew hoped to inspire other women to be proud of the power you all have when you're together, which can be amplified so much by each person. We don't want to be like other generations who are infamous for their cattiness. We want to be the new generation. Their photos showed women chipping away at the old catfighting trope. Finally, some visual evidence that we could define our own friendships. But Swift Squad sparked some heated controversy for being all white and model perfect. Taylor Swift's Girl Squad is actually anti-feminist, one headline read. Critics pointed out that such groups could be less about friendship and more about exclusion, the digital version of cliques, with the hashtag squad goals having the same effect as the Mean Girls line, "You can't sit with us." Friendships Unboxed. That Taylor takedown? It was largely about one photo on her Instagram feed, which also often includes women like Leslie Jones and Tiffany Haddish. I'd argue this incident shows just how much the world distrusts female friend packs. I get it. I had internalized the idea that women in groups are scary. When I stood outside of one in the middle school yard or sorority house lunchroom, I couldn't see how I fit into one of those circles, and I didn't know if I really wanted to. That's why it's so important to see depictions of our friendships in all their complex glory. Both on screen and off, more nuanced images change the narrative that says women are, on some level, adversaries. We're comfortable seeing men compete and collaborate. Just think of the countless examples of men doing business on the golf course, without ever questioning the validity of their friendships. Women often have to actively push against ideas about whether it's even possible for us to mix business and pleasure. But when we do, we wipe away that distrust and make way for unimaginable possibilities. It was a real friendship between Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon that jump-started the HBO series Big Little Lies. The two wanted to work together on a project focused on women and found the right one in Leanne Moriarty's novel. On stage at the 2017 Emmys, Kidman said in her acceptance speech, "This is a friendship that then created opportunities." That was true for them and the other women who worked on the show. And when we see women-run projects find success and win awards, it signals to the wider culture that there's a need for these stories. Phoebe Robinson has said she was tired of working with mostly white men in the comedy world. She wanted to see more women, people of color, and queer people. So when she met Jessica Williams while working at The Daily Show, they didn't compete for more airtime. They banded together to make something new.
Their podcast, Two Dope Queens, has been so successful that they'll co-host 4 HBO specials this year. And more important, they're helping to bring more traditionally marginalized voices to the fore. And of course, the hashtag MeToo movement shows what happens when women start from a position of believing one another. That support has allowed countless women to come forward and tell their stories at work, to their loved ones, to the media. And then more than 300 powerful women like Shonda Rhimes, Octavia Spencer, and Natalie Portman came together to launch the Time's Up Coalition to help women in sectors, including farming and housekeeping, seek legal recourse for workplace harassment. The idea is to lift other women up, rather than believe that there's room for only one woman at the top. That bolstering can happen on a smaller scale, too. When my friend Erica put one of my stories in her newsletter, she wasn't worried that I somehow might outshine her. She was proud to share my unique point of view, which got the attention of my eventual book agent. I've realized that my girlfriends give me what I always thought I got from men: strength and reliability. The respect I have for these women opened up a wider scope in my heart. No matter how vulnerable I might feel, they remind me that it's gonna be okay. They make me feel safe. All right, this next article is from 17 Magazine, and it's by Allison Caparimo. This is about the dark side of friendship, and it's called How to Deal with a Toxic Friendship. What is a toxic friendship? The tricky thing about toxic friendships is that the warning signs can be incredibly subtle, which means it's easy for them to sneak up on you. A toxic friendship is an unhealthy relationship that hurts you emotionally and can result in things like low self-esteem, self-isolation, and acting in ways you otherwise wouldn't. Natasha Shetty, assistant professor of psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center and director of psychiatric services at QCard, explains, "A toxic friendship is not the same as just a crappy friendship, but telling the difference between the two can be hard. There are shades of gray when it comes to a toxic friendship versus a friendship that's just incompatible. The main difference is that toxic relationships can affect your self-worth. If you start questioning yourself or you feel like your self-esteem is lower when you're around this friend, then that's a problem. A toxic friendship is a bad friendship with the added element of being emotionally unhealthy. Mental health includes your emotional, psychological, and social well-being. And studies show that your mental health is very much connected to your physical health. If a friend is treating you in a way that starts taking a toll on you emotionally, then they're in toxic territory." Monica R., 18 years old, says she learned the difference between a bad friend and a toxic one when she entered high school. "I had some friends in middle school who just kind of sucked. There was one who talked bad about me and another one who seemed to want to be friends just so she could get close to my guy friend, who she liked. While those friendships were frustrating, they weren't the same as the toxic one I had later on in high school. This girl and I got so close, and I trusted her with everything. Then she started acting out and being mean to me, but then would be so nice to make up for it. It got to a point where her making fun of me became just a part of our dynamic, and I really started to believe the bad things she was saying about me. That's when I knew that this was a step above someone just being a crappy friend. She was trying to drag me down, and it was working." In its most extreme form, a toxic friendship can take on the shape of emotional abuse. But how do you know if your friendship is toxic? 1. You feel on edge when you spend time together. Pay attention to how you feel before, during, and after you spend time with this friend, says Shetty. People in toxic relationships might feel nervous, on edge, frustrated, ignored, ridiculed, or guilty. If you feel like you're constantly walking on eggshells to avoid a certain negative behavior from that person, it could also be a sign the relationship is unhealthy. So the next time you find yourself anxiously stuttering while trying to chat with them or biting your nails repeatedly while reading the group text, take a step back and consider if this friendship has actually been giving back all that you've been putting in. 2. You don't like the person you become around them. People might note that they're acting in ways they otherwise wouldn't when in the company of someone toxic, says Shetty. Are you being reckless? Doing things you regret? Acting in a way that makes you feel guilt and shame when you lie down to sleep and think about your day? If you're not being you when you're around your friend, there's a chance that something's up. 3. They make you feel emotionally exhausted. If you're not sure if you have a toxic friendship on your hands, take some cues from your body.
Another marker is if you feel really drained of emotional energy after being around someone instead of feeling uplifted or supported, Shetty says. Ultimately, friends are supposed to lift you up. So if you wind up feeling anything but that when you're around someone, there might be some toxic behavior in there. 4. You rarely hang out with your other friends anymore. Another warning sign is that they might try to keep you all to themselves, according to Shetty. Convincing someone that they're isolated and have no one else to turn to is a sign of manipulation, she says. If you're isolated, you no longer have a system of checks and balances in the form of other friends telling you there's some toxicity going on. This means that the toxic friend has an easier time controlling you, and that's not good. 5. You'd never treat someone the way this friend treats you. Deep down, you know what a good friend is. A good friend listens. They're attentive. They try to be kind and respectful. They prioritize their friends while still keeping some boundaries that are important to them. Use this lens to examine how this so-called toxic friend is treating you. Do they say things you would never dream of saying? Are they doing things that you would never dare to do to a friend of yours? Do they make you feel bad? Do they take advantage of you? If their actions aren't adding up, then you might want to revisit whether this friendship really is all that. 6. You're putting in more than you're getting out. A strong friendship is mutually beneficial. It shouldn't be one-sided, says Shetty. If you feel like you're taking on a lot of care for the other person and it's not reciprocated, that's not a good sign. That's something Morgan Jensen, 22, learned from one friendship in particular. I had a friend who I literally had to baby and parent, she says. I was always cleaning up her messes. I was always coming to her rescue, always stood up for her even when she was in the wrong. I let her live with me. I let her sleep in my bed while I slept on the floor. When we would go out, I wouldn't participate in drinking, knowing she would get too drunk and I would have to be the designated driver. One day I had enough, told her how I felt, and cut her out of my life in every way possible. I stopped hanging out with people she hung out with, blocked her on everything, and I found myself finally able to breathe. And finally, 7, their personal issues start to creep into your friendship. Unfortunately, toxic relationships in general are far too common. When you enter into any kind of relationship with another person, whether it's romantic or platonic, you're making yourself vulnerable to them. As time goes on, your relationship deepens and you begin to experience more sides of the other person, and there's a chance that they might have some problematic facets or personal issues that can start to affect you. Also, there's a chance that you're both not in a good place to support each other, and that's why the friendship has entered toxic territory. Friendships can fill different needs depending on where you are in your life right now. Okay, I'll have to stop there because we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Romani Arrowsmith, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.